2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. One of the major figures of the 20th century has died. Ariel Sharon, the former prime minister of Israel, passed away over the weekend after he had suffered a stroke 8 years ago and since then had survived in what was described by his doctors as a state of minimal consciousness. Ariel Sharon, like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and so many others, was one of those figures who rode astride the 20th century. He was, in many ways, the history of his own country. His Russian parents had immigrated to the nation that would become Israel in hopes of building that country. Dedicated Zionists, they raised their own son in a collective or semi-collective farm, the forerunner to today's Israeli kibbutzes. Ariel Sharon was a figure who arose to leadership at a very young age, first of all, in terms of the military. As a young man, he entered into the armed conflict that would produce Israel, and as an older man, he became a war hero. First, in the 1967 war, known as the Six-Day War, and then again in 1973 in the Arab-Israeli War, a war that Israel also won, as it had in 1967. Ariel Sharon would become the founder of Israel's most elite military units. He was known for ruthlessness and for decisiveness as a military leader. He was also known for his central conviction, and that conviction was that Israel must defend itself, and that it would and should and must stand on its own. In his 1989 memoir entitled Warrior, he wrote, "The great question of our day is whether we, the Jewish people of Israel, can find within us the will to survive as a nation." End quote. Later in life as a politician, he was identified with the far right, but when he was elected prime minister, he actually shifted to the center, forming the Kadima party that would rule in Israel for a number of years. As prime minister, he also took a new tack when it came to dealing with the Palestinian people and the settlements in Palestinian territory. Many observers, both in the United States and elsewhere, believe that had Ariel Sharon continued to be effective in office, he would have been able to steer that conversation in a more profitable and constructive direction. But it was not to be. In 2006, Ariel Sharon suffered a massive brain incident, something like a stroke, and from 2006 to the present, he had lived in that very minimally conscious state. He died Saturday in a hospital near Tel Aviv in Israel at age 85. Another one of the lions of the 20th century has now passed, reminding us not only of the passing of time, but of the passing of people, and of the reality that many of the figures who were most influential in the 20th century, including even in the last decades of the 20th century, are now passing not only from the scene, but from this life. Ariel Sharon has been remote from his own people and from all the people of the earth since 2006. One of his two surviving sons said about his death, that Ariel Sharon, quote, went when he decided to go, end quote. That is almost surely the poetry of a son that is detached from reality. As the Bible reminds us, man knows not his time. Our times are held by God. We do not decide our own times. Ariel Sharon did not decide his own times, but he died on Saturday at age 85. At times, it's very difficult to take the measure of a story, of an incident or an event. Is it world-shaping? Is it long-lasting? Or is it ephemeral? Is it just the so-called flash in a pan? Or is it an issue of true consequence? That's one of the big questions that arises over one of the big stories from last week, the controversy surrounding New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and the revelations that members of his staff created a traffic jam in Fort Lee, New Jersey, in order to punish, for a matter of days, the Democratic mayor of that town for refusing to endorse Chris Christie for re-election. Is this a big story, or is it just an invention of the media? At this point, it's rather hard to tell. But, as anyone in the news media will tell you, there appears to be blood in the water. Political controversy draws reporters and the media attention like nothing else. The reason for that is simple. A political scandal of any scale tends to show humanity in its extremes. What we tend to find in this kind of scandal is the evil that lurks within human beings demonstrated in concentric circles of manipulation and intrigue, dishonesty and deceit, and various forms of evil doing. Of course, there are those in the national media, both in New Jersey and elsewhere, who would seek to bring down Chris Christie. This might be merely partisan, with a largely liberal and democratic media trying to take down a Republican governor, a very popular Republican governor, who is anticipated to be a frontrunner for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. But on the other hand, The national media tend to go at any story of this kind of velocity, whether or not it is a Republican or a Democrat in office. This is the kind of story that seems to have legs, as they say in the media, or that the media is going to exploit until they find out if the story has legs after all. In any event, Chris Christie was on the defensive this week after the release of a massive number of documents and emails demonstrated that against protestations to the contrary, senior members of his staff did indeed do what others had alleged, even though the imbecility and insanity of it, the absolute carnality and ridiculousness of it, would seem to indicate that no sane member of any competent political administration would have ever conceived of doing such a thing, much less ever actually doing it. But in the case of this controversy in New Jersey, aides actually did it. Governor Christie admitted to such in his press conferences and appearances last week. What the aides did was to manipulate a massive traffic jam in Fort Lee, New Jersey, in order to punish a mayor. Of course, they were actually punishing all the people of Fort Lee, New Jersey, and all those who were passing through that very highly congested area of New Jersey. And now it's the governor himself who finds himself in quite a jam. Not a traffic jam, but a political jam. And what we need to note from a leadership perspective, as Christians trying to understand this kind of story, is that almost every time a political scandal like this actually leads to the toppling of a political figure or the ending of a political career, it's not because of what actually happened at the beginning, that scandalous event that prompts the beginning of the scandal. It's about the cover-up, the concentric rings of cover-up, that then almost inevitably follow in the almost Shakespearean world of the political scandal. At the center of this scandal is the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. At a press conference last week, he said that the scandal had humiliated him. The release of the documents indicating that his staff had manipulated the traffic jam was an embarrassment to him. He said, quote, "I am a very sad person today. I am heartbroken that someone I permitted to be in that circle of trust for the past 5 years betrayed that trust," end quote. The governor went on to say that he was blindsided by the events and by the documentation that were released last week. As the governor explained himself, he had nothing to do with the instigation of the event, and as soon as the event was known to him, he made it known to others. Will this approach undertaken by Governor Christie work? Time will tell, but this much we do know. If indeed it later is proved that he did know, and thus that he lied as he was speaking to the public and to the press last week, his goose is cooked, so to speak, and his political career is effectively over. On the other hand, if he was telling the truth, and if he is perceived convincingly as having told the truth, he might be able to rescue his political fortunes. In that case, a manipulated traffic jam hardly looks like a disqualifying factor for a national presidential run. But that's where the other aspect of this story gains particular traction. If it was the event itself, it's probably not a big issue. But if there was a cover-up of the original event, that's going to be deadly. As Mark Santora and Kate Zernike of the New York Times report, officials loyal to Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey went to elaborate means to make it appear that the September closing of lanes leading to the George Washington Bridge was part of a traffic study, even though their private communications suggest the move was purely political, according to documents released last Friday, end quote. If that's where the cover-up leads and that's where it ends, it probably isn't that big of a story. But if the cover-up was followed by an additional cover-up that was covered up in order to cover up the original cover-up, well, what you can give up is the political career of a certain governor of New Jersey. Meanwhile, shifting the scene to the states of Washington and Colorado, the issue of legal recreational marijuana is getting a lot of worldwide attention, and some business page attention as well. There are many who are speculating that the next big breakout industry in America is the industry of marijuana. And the recent flurry of activity in Colorado, especially as people are flocking to that state to buy legal marijuana, indicates that it just might have an industrial power economic impact behind it. Now even states like Florida are considering what legal recreational marijuana might mean, not only for the state, but for its economy. In an opinion piece published in the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel, Phil Latzman suggests that the state of Florida should realize that a windfall could come with the legalization of marijuana. He mentions the fact that nearly 1 million state signatures in Florida have already been gathered on a petition asking that medical marijuana be put in front of the voters of Florida in November. And at least one poll indicates that 82% of Americans say they will vote yes. The push is then to move from medical marijuana to what is called in Colorado recreational marijuana. Looking to Colorado, Mr. Latzman writes, It's estimated that 30% of sales will come from out of state. The extra visitors immediately boost tourism, meaning additional millions for hotels, attractions, and resorts, along with the taxes that go with it. Legalizing pot may also help eliminate the criminal element, making streets and neighborhoods safer, and freeing police to enforce more important laws. The effect, he says, could ease the burden on prisons overcrowded with minor drug offenders and save the state millions more in incarceration costs, end quote. It almost makes you want to put that to music. That's just one paragraph from his opinion article. And what he's clearly suggesting is that there is big money to be made in marijuana, and it is only stupid for a state not to go after that money. Given all the promises and blessings that he says the sale of legal marijuana would bring to a state, it's a wonder it didn't promise that all the trains and buses would run on time. He then writes this very interesting paragraph, quote, marijuana usage isn't for everyone, especially the underdeveloped minds of children. As the parent of two teenagers, I worry about that. But most can agree that it is safer and less addictive than alcohol, and its negative consequences of usage less severe, especially behind the wheel, end quote. It seems to me that it was grossly irresponsible for the Fort Lauderdale News and Sun Sentinel to run that article. What in the world does it mean for them to run even an opinion piece that claims that there is a less significant factor to smoking marijuana and then driving than drinking and driving? He cites no scientific statistic, and there is no evidence whatsoever that is produced in order to support his case. That's a very reckless argument, and it is extremely irresponsible of the newspaper to give him that forum in order to make such an assertion. It's also very interesting that as a parent, he identifies himself here as the parent of two teenagers, he admits that marijuana can be dangerous for the underdeveloped minds of children, and he says, I worry about that. But he obviously doesn't worry about it very much. Speaking to the other side of the issue, Washington Post editorialist Ruth Marcus makes the other side's case very clearly. She writes, on balance, society will not be better off with another legal mind-altering substance. In particular, our kids will not be better off with another legal mind-altering substance. She cites the American Medical Association, concluding, as it recommended against the legalization of marijuana last November, quote, cannabis is a dangerous drug and as such is a public health concern. The AMA went on to say it is the most common illicit drug involved in drugged driving, particularly in drivers under the age of 21. Early cannabis use of the AMA is related to later substance use disorders. Ruth Marcus says that a final point from the AMA is most convincing. Quote, heavy cannabis use in adolescents causes persistent impairments in neurocognitive performance and IQ, and use is associated with increased rates of anxiety, mood, and psychotic disorders. Ruth Marcus then cited a study in which more than 1,000 New Zealanders from birth to age 38 were studied as related to marijuana. That study found that, quote, persistent cannabis use was associated with neuropsychological decline broadly across domains of functioning, even after controlling for years of education. She went on to say that long-term users were found to have an average decline of 8 IQ points. Then this statement, quote, impairment was concentrated among adolescent onset cannabis users with more persistent use associated with greater decline. In other words, the more marijuana that was used and the earlier it was experienced, the more cognitive decline was easily then calculated and observed. Then on Friday, writing in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, Mitchell Rosenthal, a child psychiatrist, said, pot is always good for a giggle, and that makes it hard to take marijuana seriously. But as he goes on to say, that is a huge mistake. It's nothing to laugh about. He says legalizing marijuana isn't just amusing, it's increasingly popular with legislators and the public. And then he writes, yet marijuana is far from safe, despite the widespread effort to make it seem benign. Pot damages the heart and lungs, increases the incidence of anxiety, depression, and schizophrenia, and it can trigger acute psychotic episodes. Many adults appear to be able to use marijuana with relatively little harm, but the same cannot be said of adolescents, who are about twice as likely as adults to become addicted to marijuana. Dr. Rosenthal then writes, the Colorado law limits pot sales to people 21 or older, but making marijuana available for recreational use normalizes it in society. The drug will be made more easily available to those under 21, and how long until the age limit is dropped to 18, end quote. Dr. Rosenthal then includes this very interesting and perceptive paragraph. He writes, no one can say how marijuana legalization will play out. A perception of legal marijuana as safe, combined with sophisticated marketing, may well double or triple pot use. Warning of aggressive promotion, drug policy expert Mark Kleiman, who studied potential issues of a legal marijuana market for the Seattle City Council, pointed out last year, quote, "The only way to sell a lot of pot is to create a lot of potheads," end quote. It's almost certainly true, if you think about it, that marijuana isn't the biggest moral issue we face. There are far larger and more urgent issues related to sexuality, the breakdown of marriage, the marginalization of the family, and any number of other moral concerns. But that is not to say that marijuana is unimportant. To say that it is not the leading and most urgent moral issue we now face is not to say that it is not an issue that will affect millions of lives. Furthermore, the whole issue of marijuana is right in the center of the great cultural change we are now experiencing, a moral revolution. As I pointed out before, and has been noticed by so many others as well, it seems to be no accident that the issues of homosexuality and marijuana are riding the same moral revolution at the present. They are at this time two very important issues, not equal in importance, but very similar and parallel in development, that demonstrate to us how a moral revolution takes place, how a change in the minds of a people, of a culture or a society takes place before our eyes. The numbers related to same-sex marriage and marijuana acceptance are hauntingly parallel. If you go back even just a few years, a huge majority of Americans believed that both same-sex marriage and marijuana use were not only wrong, but morally wrong, and that both should be addressed in terms of legislation. Now, just a few years later, there appears to have been a tremendous, massive moral revolution, such that the issue has not only come to a closing of the gap, but of an actual moral revolution in which the numbers have almost flipped, with a sizable majority now believing, or at least saying they believe, in the legalization of same-sex marriage and in the legalization of the use of marijuana. From a Christian worldview perspective, one thing to note is that there often seems to be the experience of a people going into a moral revolution on one issue, unable to keep other issues from being swept into the same revolution. In this case, I think there's something else at work as well. There's a lack of resolve on the part of the American people on the issue of marijuana and same-sex marriage to say what they actually believe to be true, but rather to believe that the issue is simply over, and that the most important thing someone can do, or the easiest thing that the society can do at this point, is simply to give in to the revolution. Finally, on the issue of marijuana, sometimes you see something that you believe just must be a parody, and then you find out it's not. Writing at the Huffington Post, a theologian who came of age in the 60s, a liberal theologian, has urged that society should legalize the use of marijuana for theological reasons, because marijuana aids in the theology of the body. The theologian is Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite. I've debated her before. She was previously president of the liberal Chicago Theological Seminary. Now writing at the Huffington Post, she says that if you think about a theology of the body, both for the society and for the individual, the legalization of marijuana just makes sense. Amazingly, she claims even a biblical support for her argument. She asked the question, thinking of the individual marijuana user, is it good to smoke pot if it's legal? Is it moral? Dr. Thistlethwaite then claims a biblical warrant for suggesting that even as Jesus turned water into wine at the wedding at Cana of Galilee, we should understand that intoxication is not something foreign to the New Testament. We should note that while there is no question that the Bible clearly reveals that Jesus did turn water into wine at his first miracle there at Cana, such wine would not be intended to be used as an intoxicant at all. As a matter of fact, the Bible clearly warns against any use of wine as an intoxicant. Her last sentence reads, "That is only common sense, and common sense is one of the best guides to morality," end quote. Now wait just a minute. She was claiming earlier to have a theological rationale, and later to have even a biblical rationale. Now she appears to have given those up, and all she's claiming is common sense. But, as has often been noted, when someone claims that something simply amounts to common sense, it is rarely either common or sensical, and that is certainly true in this case. A final observation, when you come across an article like this published with the title, Marijuana, a Theology, a couple of things seem to be apparent. First of all, what you're going to find is muddled thinking at best on marijuana. But secondly, and even more tragically, you're going to note what kind of nonsense passes for theology in the declining neighborhoods of liberal Protestantism. As I said, when I saw the article, I believed it must be a parody. But actually, it's not. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from West Palm Beach, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.